On today's episode, we're discussing a Wall Street playboy who at the age of just 28 was investigated over a $250 million loss to his insurance company empire after checking himself into a mental hospital and relocating from New York to South Carolina. Alexander Chatfield Burns amassed a huge number of businesses in his mid-20s, including several insurance companies. Colleagues said he would regularly attend cigar clubs, the finest restaurants, and even donated wine to the Guggenheim Museum in the city. But all was not as it appeared to be. The financier faced growing questions once he booked himself into Bellevue Hospital and resigned from Southport Lane Management LLC, leaving a series of unusual asset transfers behind. Regulators in Delaware say Southport, under Mr. Burns, siphoned off millions of dollars of mainstream insurance holdings and swapped them with assets that were either overvalued or worthless. Among them is a painting initially believed to be by Caravaggio, but was later discredited as a copy by three art experts. The Wall Street Journal reported that Mr. Burns had two insurance companies, two offshore reinsurers, a brokerage firm, and a web of dealings with other insurers. His massive portfolio left him in charge of investing hundreds of millions of dollars in additional assets. A big responsibility for who was thought to be a young savant. A really smart friend once asked Burns how he got control of four state-regulated insurance companies. With a Cheshire Cat grin, Burns cryptically responded, "Jesus with a telescope on Mars couldn't figure out how I did this." But eventually, someone did. And that someone is author Richard Bailey, who's a certified fraud examiner. Who says accountants don't lead exciting lives? So stay tuned as we talk to Richard Bailey about how he answered the question that everybody wondered about. Was the savant's life too good to be true? Find out right now on Tax Crime Junkies. Welcome back, everyone, to Tax Crime Junkies. I'm your host, Dominique. I'm a CPA, certified tax strategist, leader of the American Institute of Certified Tax Planners with a degree in law. And with me, as always, is my oh-so-lovable co-host, Tom Gorzinski.
Hey, everybody. I'm Tom Gorzinski. I'm an enrolled agent. I'm admitted to practice before the U.S. Tax Court as a law attorney. I'm a tax planner. And like you, I love true crime. I love tax. And Dominique and I have this great podcast called The Tax Crime Junkies. So welcome to today's episode.
And today we've got a very special treat for you. With us is Richard Bailey. And Richard's new book has just been released. It's called Pirate Cove, an insider's account of the infamous Southport Lane scandal. And I have to say, this was a riveting read for me. Richard's background is as a certified fraud examiner, and he's got a lengthy and extensive experience history. He's been working in the profession for more than 30 years, and he's been providing financial management and corporate development services to companies that are in distress.
Right.
And it sounds so exciting to me. He kind of goes from company to company in many different industries, brings his expertise and knowledge to turn those companies around. So he has worked with private equity firms before, or even directly with owners of companies. And he has worked in private manufacturing, service industries, distribution companies, wineries, as we'll talk about today. And he's from the East Coast, born and raised in New Haven, Connecticut. Richard, welcome to the show. We're so glad to have you.
Well, thank you. Thank you for asking me to be on.
Richard, when did you start writing this book, Pirate Cove?
I started writing it for real just 2 years ago, in the end of October 2021, when I was informed by, without jumping too far ahead, the FBI, that my boss, who hired me to turn around this vineyard on Long Island, had committed suicide in Charleston, South Carolina.
So a couple things stood out about that. FBI and boss committing suicide?
Yeah, I think we need some detail on that story before we move forward.
But it's a true story.
Of course.
And it is a true story.
Yeah, that always gets my heart racing a little bit because, in my opinion, you can't make some of this stuff up. Fact can be definitely stranger than fiction. But in this book in particular, you're writing about your experience with Alexander Chatfield Burns. And he was described as a financial prodigy, a young man in terms of his career and experience. And it seemed from the very beginning, Richard, that people sort of looked at Alexander as a savant of some sort in the investment arena.
That's actually spot on. When I first met Alex, he was 26 years old. He had been running and he had founded this private equity firm, Southport Lane, and they had, you know, a full floor in Midtown Manhattan at 350 Madison Avenue. When you went in there, it was, you know, the walls were lined with, you know, framed old stock certificates. So it reeked of, and it was set up to impress. And I've been in a lot of, you know, my father was in the business, you know, my grandfather was in the business. I've been in a lot of Wall Street offices in my life. It was set up to look like a good, solid, stable investment management company.
It sounds like it.
And it was none of those things.
Right.
Well, that's usually why you end up on this show, Richard, is because it's that what you see is not necessarily the truth. Here you have this young person that everybody's looking up to. In your book, you describe him as Jimmy Neutron, which just was such an apropos description. I did not do any research before reading your book, and I'm glad I didn't, because all throughout the entire book, I'm picturing Jimmy Neutron in these experiences you're describing.
Well, the Jimmy Neutron, let me just say, those of us who are still in touch from the Southport Lane experience, we all still refer to Alex as Jimmy Neutron or just Neutron. But the Jimmy Neutron at the time was a cartoon that my two sons, who were, you know, at that point, you know, 10 and 8, what they were watching. And
yeah,
it was about a boy genius who saved the world in every episode while bumbling his way to saving the world. And to me, it just kind of fit after my first one or two meetings with Alex.
Sure. So you had a friend, you've described in the story that you had a friend that was working at the firm and he loves your work and recommended you to come in and apply for a job or discuss an opening that they had. So tell me about that experience. And did you do any research ahead of time? And what did you find the most intriguing about Burns in particular?
Well, the research I did ahead of time is that this firm, Southport Lane, seems to have sprung out of nowhere. You know, right. There was usually when you see a private equity firm that says they're managing, they have $1 billion under management, there is, you know, an ex-KKR or Bain Capital or somebody or Goldman Sachs guy who has been doing deals for years. And, you know, they're going out on their own because they've, you know, got a book of business. They've got a stable of advisors and investors. And, you know, they have, you know, a focused strategy on how they're going to make their investors money.
So you would add money. They usually have some sort of money to start off with.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
They've made a bunch of it.
Yeah. And, you know, it turned out South, this is one of the things that started kind of making me kind of wonder about it. Southport Lane had none of those things.
Mm.
You know, it had, you know, everybody was there. I mean, there were nice people there. And we'll talk about my friend Jeff in a second. There were nice people there. There were competent people there. But, you know, this wasn't exactly the A-team of corporate finance.
Right.
You know, there was a lot of journeyman guys who had, you know, washed out of brokerage firms and things of that nature and banks and financial management, you know, who might have spent a couple of years at a big bank, but that was about it. And so it was a lot of those guys. And each guy, it was very secretive. Nobody really talked to each other about what anybody else was doing.
Oh.
So I was sitting there. This is January of 2013. I was sitting here, you know, kind of licking my wounds after a deal that I did which did not work well. And Jeff calls me and says that he's, my friend Jeff Leach, who is just a stand-up guy, calls me and says, you know, we've got this pharmaceutical company in northern New Jersey. You want to take a look at it? You know, we're going to make a majority investment in it. None of these, I don't trust any of the people here at Southport Lane to go and do the due diligence. Would you be interested? You know, it's $5,000 for a week. I'm like, when do I leave? You know, so I would, right. You know, I'll go now. You know, my wife looked at me and said, bye-bye, you know. but I went down there and I spent, you know, 4 days, you know, there, 4.5 days there. And the place was just losing money hand over fist. There was no controls. It was a family owned business. So I, you know, hopped in the car, went to Southport Lane. This is the first time I met Alex Burns. And, you know, he sits there and says to me, well, he said a lot of odd things in that meeting to me, but he said, should I buy this company? Well, I'll just leave it nameless, just, you know, because I don't want to sit there and hurt the company because they're they're doing quite well now. And he said, you know, should I buy this company? I said, no. And everybody, there's like six people in the room. Everybody kind of looks at me and goes, why not? I said, because you're going to lose all your money.
Yeah.
I said, this is a family business. I said, every wedding, every, you know, event, every holiday, every time they all get together, they're going to have a board meeting and you're never going to be there. And they don't really need a big slug of cash. And besides, they've already got an investor who's a billionaire, who's friends with, you know, the father of the team that's running it, you know, so he's injecting capital. So, you're just never going to get there. You're going to lose all your money.
Well, that should be exactly why they brought you in, was to tell them this piece of information, right?
Right. But the way the setup was at Southport Lane is Alex brought all these people in to bring him deals. All right. And if they did the deal, all these guys who were sitting at the desks and, you know, dialing for dollars during the course of the day, they would get a success fee. Now, I'd never heard of a private equity firm giving a success fee to the originators of the deal. That's not how private equity works.
Sure.
So, you know, small little, like, you know, alarm bell goes off in the back of my head. You know, private equity works where you buy a company, you fix it, you sell it for more than you bought it.
Right.
You know, and that's, you know, that's kind of the standard cookie cutter. These guys had they didn't care about that. They didn't care about, you know, the day after you close, what are you doing? There was no discussions about that. No due diligence about that. You know, there was no, you know, okay, how do we sit there and grow this thing by, you know, 10X in, you know, the next, you know, 5+ years? None of that.
Right.
None of it. So, they didn't care about what happens the day after the close. Everybody just wanted to get to the closing so that they could get their fee.
Sure. So they're incentivizing the wrong thing, because that might lead someone to overlook the warning signs of a company and really ignore the profitability that potential. And that's really what you were there to examine. So they were kind of upset with your assessment on that, right?
Correct.
Because now they don't get their bonuses.
Right.
Because you're talking Jimmy Neutron out of that deal.
Right. Right. And, you know, and to me, first of all, nobody told me that was the business model internally at Southport Lane. You know, my friend Jeff had just been made the president of Southport Lane. I love him dearly, but, you know, he's not, you know, Jeff is a extremely good high-end relationship guy. You know, I've known him and worked with him for over 25 years. I used to say back in the late 90s, when we were both at a small private equity firm together, just give Jeff an American Express card and, you know, a travel budget, and he'll bring in enough business for everybody, you know, which, you know, remained true for the next 20+ years, you know. So, but, you know, Jeff didn't, you know, nobody had told me that was the business model. Everybody's there to get a fee. And I just was like, you know, then you're not a private equity company.
Right.
Right.
Now,
and what do they need you for? It doesn't really matter what you find.
Right. Right. I mean, you know, if all you're concerned about is getting to the deal closing and not worrying about what happens the day after that, then, you know, you're just, you know, you're kind of a drive-by investor.
But they must have respected your opinion because it sounds like they didn't move forward with the deal.
They didn't. Well, they did for a while, but then they sat there and they stopped. I think Alex Burns, and I talk about this a little bit in the book, Alex Burns, I think, was just surprised that somebody had said this is a bad idea. You know, and, you know, to something that he was already starting to spend money on. And for some reason, I think he respected that. So he literally called me into his office after that meeting. After that, I was like, I didn't, you know, I was apologizing to Jeff. I was just feeling terrible. I just sat there and, you know, dropped a bomb in the middle of what was supposed to be a positive let's go meeting. And Burns said, you know, that was fun. And then he said, you know, do you like wine? I said, yeah, I, you know, like to drink it, you know. And he goes, okay. He goes, well, we may have something for you. And, you know, then I went and I told Jeff, we decided to meet at a bar about three blocks away. And that's what I learned about, like, just how weird. That's what I learned about the fee angle of all their investments.
Right. Right.
After that. And I'm just sitting there going, this is rough. And that's where incidentally, at that meeting, no, it wasn't a meeting. We were just hanging around drinking. At that meeting in the bar is when I first used the Jimmy Neutron camera.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm like, so this guy, where does he come off like this?
Exactly, right? By then, your spidey senses are starting to go off on some of these warning signs. And so maybe it's not appropriate at your job interview to ask where they got all their money.
Right.
Where did they get all their money? Did you ever find out and kind of walk us through in layman's terms, if you can, you know, where did the money come from? And that's sort of where the scandal comes in.
Right.
Well, they had done a couple of things. They had acquired several insurance companies, Dallas National Insurance Company in Dallas, Imperial Insurance Company in Louisiana, another one in, they renamed it Southport Re down in the Cayman Islands, and they bought into an insurance company in South Carolina that was affiliated with Blue Cross Blue Shield. They did so by printing up bogus stock certificates and depositing them at a very large custodial bank who, you know, should have known better. And that custodial bank accepted. And the third party that they contracted to value and validate the securities was also another Southport affiliated company.
So you're saying that it was a stock sale or swap, or they used these stock certificates as collateral and promised payouts at some future date?
It's great to talk to attorneys about this. It was a stock sale and a stock swap, and it was in the third party custodial bank provided the opinion that these securities were of legitimate value. All right. And so the thing really started to blow up like a year later when people couldn't liquidate those securities.
Oh, sure. Because at some point, the sellers of the business want to get cash out of the deal.
Right.
Yeah. And by the way, all of these insurance companies were distressed in some way, shape, or form.
Woo.
So you can cut and the insurance regulators in each state, as you know, there's no national regulator for insurance. It's regulated each state individually. But the insurance regulators in Texas and Louisiana, they are putting essentially stops on, you know, the payment to the sellers for a period of time after the sale, so that these securities just sat in the accounts at the third-party custodial bank.
And insurance companies, you mentioned the regulators there, don't they have to have a lot of cash reserves or at least liquid assets and reserves to pay claims?
Yes. And one of the things that Southport also did, and at Dallas National Insurance, they were one of the requirements was that they had to put $50 million onto the bank, onto the balance sheet in cash or marketable securities, you know, which is near to cash in the eyes of, you know, accountants and insurance regulators.
Sure.
And so they had to put the marketable securities. Now, they created the marketable securities on their office computers. And again, deposited those into the third-party custodian account.
Oh. So what do you think are the major red flags that were missed by the regulators that could have brought an end to this situation sooner?
That's a good question. The major red flags should have been a lack of operating history on behalf of the company and the principals. The major red flag should have been there was no real valid independent valuation of the securities. Southport created something called administrative agency services. That's what provided the valuation of the securities, which were the currency for the transfer of the stock.
So it's themselves telling the value of the stock.
Right.
Right, but nobody ever sat there and looked behind and said, okay, so who's administrative agencies?
So they couldn't identify that it was a related party.
Right.
Wow.
It was all related parties. It was just, you know, it was a massive like shell game, just moving things around.
Right. So I imagine this took some time to be discovered. And in the meantime, you have now connected with Alex and he's asked you if you like wine. And what did he mean by that question? You kind of said, well, yeah, I like to drink wine. What was his intention behind that question?
Alex had purchased Lieb Cellars and Premium Wine Group out on the North Fork of Long Island, which is a wine area. Unbeknownst to me, I literally grew up across Long Island Sound on the Connecticut shore, staring over at Long Island until I was about 25 years old. I had no idea they made wine. They grew grapes over there. Yeah, but so I go out there, and he had already purchased it. So the day before I leave to go out there, I get a FedEx here at home, and, you know, I look at it when I'm on the boat, and you have to take a ferry from New London, Connecticut, over to Orient Point, New York. It's about an hour and a half, hour and 15 minutes. And so I decide, okay, I'm going to read the acquisition documents, because that's what they had sent me. First of all, I pull out the acquisition documents, and there were three different companies acquired, and the documents were about 12 pages per company. Now,
that's it.
Most of the lawyers that I have employed in my life doing M&A work can't get through the definitions in 12 pages.
Yeah.
Right.
You know? And so then I sit there and I'm looking at it and I'm going, okay, they paid a total of $12.75 million. In cash, you know, wire transferred cash for the vineyard. And they had sent me the financial statements, and I can't get past $5.7 million in value. So why did they sit there and buy this vineyard for $12.75 million? And I've valued a lot of companies. I've actually valued companies for people's divorces and things like that.
Okay.
A lot of companies out there, and I can't get past 5.5, 5.7.
But so they basically paid more than double what you're observing this company is worth. And right away you're going, what's wrong with that deal? My question is, where did the cash come from?
Right.
Because I expected you to say they bought this with a stock swap.
Nope. They sat there and once they put the quote-unquote $50 million to plug the hole in the balance sheet of Dallas National Insurance Company, then they just started creating more securities and literally selling them to the insurance company that they owned. And the insurance company would buy those securities, put them on their balance sheet, and they would transfer, you know, tens of millions of dollars at the beginning.
Which was just the cash flow of the insurance company, right? These are operational companies, so they're getting premiums in.
Right.
Yeah. So that's exactly what they were doing. So, you know, they had done that significantly to the tune where they could at least come up with $12.75 million in cash. And I think by that point, if I had to go back and push the numbers around, I think by that point they had probably taken 60 to 70 million out of the various insurance companies.
That's amazing.
That's shocking that the companies could withstand that amount of cash leaving the business.
Well, you know, they're insurance companies. So, I mean, you know, there's always steady cash coming in.
Yeah.
You know? So that can cover, that type of cash flow can cover a lot of sins of omission and commission. So, but, you know, there was a significant amount of cash but on their reserves for, you know, excess premium, but not enough to satisfy the regulators, which is why the regulators asked them to put the $50 million in. So they were swapping out the bogus securities for the actual cash on the balance sheet.
Ah, wow.
Now, you know, one of the most fascinating parts of this story to me is the Caravaggio paint. I just thought it was so interesting. Could you explain the role this painting has in this entire scandal?
What they were trying to do was they were trying to securitize non-liquid assets, you know, alternative assets. So they found, one of the guys found, Andrew Scheer found this guy who knew a guy who knew a guy, you know, the way those things work, who had this Caravaggio of David with the head of Goliath.
Oh, wow.
Oh, okay.
You know, so, which by the way, the real one is in the Prado in Spain.
This was not a real.
So this was a four-three war. Okay.
As everybody says, it was of dubious provenance. So they sat there and then they did a contract where they paid somebody $1.5 million and gave him a note for $38 million. So they paid the equivalent of, like, you know, $39.5 million. All right, the rest was a note. They weren't allowed to sit there and take it. They weren't allowed to, you know, to show it. They weren't allowed to claim ownership. But they just ignored what they weren't allowed to do according to the purchase and sale contract for the, under the terms of the purchase sale contract for the Caravaggio. And they put it on the balance sheet of one of the insurance companies for $128 million.
That is unbelievable. That is unbelievable.
Did it come up on the, was the trial balance account called Art, or name of the?
I don't know. That's funny. I've never seen the financials for the insurance companies. I never got too close to the insurance companies because I was pretty aware at that point when I started getting probably 6 months there at Southport. I was like, there's so many things that are just definitely wrong here. So I never really wanted to get too close to the insurance companies, and I actually stayed away from the. From the insurance guys at Southport. I just like, no, that's what's going on in there, you know, is definitely not right. It's, you know, there's something wrong about it.
So no priceless works of art were on the balance sheet of the winery?
No, nothing like that. The winery was actually, the financial statements were actually pretty close to being accurate. I mean, the accountant that they had, the outside CFO service that they had was terrible. And they used misclassified things constantly, like bottles for, you know, bottling the wine, you know, in some months are capitalized and some months are expensed. You know, so they did a lot of, you know, really kind of funky things that way. But that was just, and those are errors of just not being familiar enough with GAAP and doing everything in QuickBooks.
Also be a tax fraud as well, because when you're expensing parts of inventory that are required to be capitalized, you're going to lower your taxable income.
Well, but it was a stock sale. So if that was a tax fraud, it would have been our tax fraud.
Right.
So, yeah, but there was nothing of that nature that they were doing with the insurance companies on the books of the wine company until one day.
And don't hate me, but we have to stop there. We want you to come back, though, because in the next episode, Richard Bailey takes us further into the complex world of Southport Lane. He's going to reveal the startling aftermath of the scandal, including the unraveling of Burns's empire and the widespread impact on the financial sector. Stay tuned for the turning point of the scandal and discover how the house of cards began to collapse, leading to intense legal battles and the ultimate downfall of key players, including death. hear about the personal risks and ethical dilemmas Richard faced as he goes undercover to navigate the treacherous waters of this scandal. Stay tuned for part two of the Southport Scandal, Unraveling a Financial Prodigy's Web of Deceit. It's an episode you do not want to miss.